I tend to have a lot of demands. Menshiki very patiently followed my nagging directions. He never looked put out, never complained. I pegged him as a person experienced in putting up with all sorts of trials and difficulties. When he finally got the pose right, I said, I'm very sorry, but try to hold that pose without moving. Menshiki said nothing, only his eyes indicating that he understood. I'll try to finish as quickly as I can. It might be hard, but please be patient. Once again, he nodded with his eyes. He kept his gaze still, his body unmoving, literally not moving a muscle. He did have to blink a few times, but I couldn't even tell if he was breathing. He was so still, he looked like a lifelike statue. I couldn't help but be impressed. Even professional art models find it hard to get to that point. As Menshiki endured posing, I worked on the canvas as quickly and efficiently as I could. I concentrated, eyeing his figure, and moved my brush as my intuition dictated. I was using black paint on the white canvas, and with a single fine brushstroke, fleshed out the outline of his face I'd already drawn. No time even to re-grip the brush. In a limited amount of time, I had to capture the various elements that made up his face and get them down on canvas. At a certain point, the process switched over to something close to autopilot. It's important to bypass your conscious mind and get your eye and hand movements in sync. There's no time to consciously process every single thing your gaze takes in. This demanded a very different type of process from me compared with the numerous portraits I'd done up till then, the countless business items I'd leisurely painted based solely on memory and photographs. In about 15 minutes, I'd gotten him from the chest up on canvas. It was just a rough, incomplete outline, but at least I was able to capture an image that seemed to breathe a sense of vitality, one that managed to scoop out and capture the sort of internal movement that gave birth to who this person was. If this were an anatomical drawing, though, it would be just the bones and muscles, the internal part alone, boldly laid bare. It needed actual flesh and skin laid on over it. Thank you, you've been very patient, I said. That's enough for today. You can take it easy now. Menshiki smiled and relaxed his pose. He stretched his hands above him and took a deep breath. He slowly massaged his face with his fingers to loosen up the tense muscles. I stood there taking a few deep breaths. It took a while for my breathing to return to normal. I was exhausted, like a sprinter who'd just finished a race. I'd had to work speedily, with intense concentration and with no room for compromise, something I hadn't experienced for quite some time. I'd had to flex long, dormant muscles, and though I felt tired, it also felt good.
Like you said, sitting for a painting is a lot harder work than I'd imagined, Menshiki said. When I think about you painting me, it feels like my insides are slowly being scraped away.
The official view in the art world is that it's not being scraped away, but rather transplanted to a different place, I said.
Transplanted to a more permanent, lasting place?
Yes, if the painting is a true work of art.
Like, for instance, the nameless mailman who lives on in Van Gogh's portrait of him?
Exactly.
He probably had no idea that well over a century later, countless people around the world would visit art museums or look through art books and gaze intently at his portrait. I'm sure he never had a clue. It was some odd painting done in a corner of a shabby country kitchen, painted by a man who, whichever way you look at it, was a little off.
I nodded.
It's kind of weird, Menshiki said. Something that, on the face of it, shouldn't be so lasting, ends up having permanent value. Not something that happens every day. I suddenly thought of killing Commendatore. Through Tomohiko Amata's hand, was the Commendatore given permanent life, even though he was stabbed to death in the painting? And who was this Commendatore anyway? I offered Manshiki some coffee. That would be nice, he replied, and I went to the kitchen and made a fresh pot. Manshiki remained on the chair in the studio, listening to the opera record. The coffee was ready as the B-side of the record came to an end, and we went into the living room to drink it.
So, does it look like you can do a good portrait of me?
Manshiki asked as he delicately sipped his coffee. I'm not sure yet, I answered honestly. I don't know if it will turn out well. The way I've painted portraits up till now has been so different from this.
Because you're using an actual model this time?
Manshiki asked. That's one reason, but only a part of it. I don't know why, but it's like I'm not able anymore to paint the sort of conventional portraits I've done up till now. I need a different method and procedure, but those are still out of reach. I'm still fumbling in the dark.
Which means you really are changing, and I'm the catalyst for that change, wouldn't you say?
You may be right. Manshiki thought for a while before speaking.
As I told you before, it's entirely up to you what style of painting you do. I'm a person who's always seeking change, always in flux, and it's not like I'm hoping you'll paint some conventional portrait. Any style, any concept is fine. What I want is for you to depict me exactly as you see me. The methods and procedure are up to you. I'm not hoping I live on like that mailman from Arles. I'm not that ambitious. I just have a healthy curiosity to see what sort of painting will emerge from this.
I appreciate your saying that. I just have one request, I said. If I can't come up with a satisfactory painting, then I'd like to forget the whole thing.
You won't give me the painting then?
I nodded. I'll return the advance, of course.
All right, Manshiki said. I'll let you be the final judge. Though I must say I have a strong hunch it's not going to turn out that way.
I hope your hunch turns out to be correct.
Manshiki looked me in the eyes. But even if the painting's never completed, I'd be very happy if, in some way, I'm able to help you change. Truly.
By the way, Mr. Manshiki, I said, broaching the topic a little while later, there's something I wanted to get your advice on. Something personal, nothing to do with the painting.
Of course. I'll be happy to help if I can.
I sighed. It's kind of a weird story. I might not be able to tell the whole story in the right order, so it makes sense.
Take your time. Tell it in whatever order is easiest for you. And then we'll consider it together. The two of us might come up with a good idea that you couldn't come up with on your own.
So I told him the story, start to finish. How I suddenly woke up just before 2 a.m. and heard a weird sound in the darkness. A faint, far-off sound that I could only catch because the insects had stopped chirping. A sound like someone ringing a bell. When I tried to trace the source, it seemed to be coming from between the cracks in a stone mound in the woods behind my house. That mysterious sound continued for some 45 minutes, intermittently, with irregular intervals of silence between. Finally, it stopped completely. The same thing happened two nights in a row, two nights ago and last night. Someone might be ringing that bell-like thing from underneath the stones, maybe sending out a distress call. But could that be possible? I was starting to doubt my own sanity a little. Was I just imagining things?
Manshiki listened to my story without comment and remained silent even after I finished. He'd listened intently to what I'd said, and I could tell he was thinking deeply about it.
"A fascinating story," he said a little while later. He lightly cleared his throat. "As you said, it's certainly out of the ordinary. I wonder, if possible, I'd like to hear the sound of that bell myself. So could I come over tonight, if you don't mind?"
This took me by surprise. "Come all the way over here in the dead of night?"
"Of course. If I hear the bell too, that would prove you're not hallucinating. That's the first step. If it is an actual bell, then let's try to locate the source, the two of us. Then we can think about what to do next."
"True enough. If you don't mind, I'll come over here tonight at 12:30. Does that work for you?"
"That's fine, but I don't want to put you out."
A pleasant smile graced his lips.
"Not to worry. If I can help you, nothing would make me happier. Plus, I'm a very curious person. What that bell in the middle of the night might mean, and if someone is ringing it, who that is, I'm dying to know."
"You feel the same way, don't you?"
"Of course," I said.
"Then let's go with that.
I'll see you tonight. And there's something else I thought of."
"Excuse me?"
"I'll tell you about it later. I have to make sure of something first."
Manshiki got up from the sofa and held out his right hand. I shook it, as always a firm handshake. He looked happier than usual. After he left, I spent the rest of the afternoon in the kitchen, cooking. Once a week, I prepare all my meals. I put them in the fridge or freezer, then get by on these for the week. This was my meal prep day. For dinner that evening, I added macaroni to some boiled sausage and cabbage, plus a tomato, avocado, and onion salad. In the evening, I lay on the sofa as always, reading while listening to music. After a while, I stopped reading and thought about Manshiki. Why had he looked so happy when we said goodbye? Was he really so pleased to be able to help me out? Why? I didn't get it. I was just a poor, unknown artist. My wife of 6 years had left me. I didn't get along with my parents, had no set place to live, no assets, and was simply hanging out in a friend's father's house. Manshiki, in contrast, not that there was any need to make a comparison, had been successful at business at a young age and made enough to live comfortably for the rest of his days. At least, that's what he had told me. He was good-looking, owned 4 British cars, and lived in luxury in a huge mountaintop mansion without, apparently, doing any real work. So why would a person like that be interested in someone like me? And why would he make time in the dead of the night to help me out? I shook my head and went back to reading. Thinking about it wasn't going to get me anywhere. It was like trying to put together a puzzle that was missing some pieces. I could think all I wanted and never arrive at any conclusion, but I couldn't help but think about it. I sighed and put the book on the tabletop again, closed my eyes, and listened to the music. Schubert's String Quartet No. 15, played by the Vienna Konzerthaus Quartet. Since coming here, I'd listened to classical music every day, most of it German or Austrian, since the majority of Tomohiko Amada's record collection consisted of German classical music. His collection included the obligatory nods to Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Sibelius, Vivaldi, Debussy, and Ravel. But that's all. Since he was an opera fan, there were, as you might expect, some recordings by Verdi and Puccini. But compared to the substantial lineup of German opera, he didn't seem as enthusiastic about these.
I imagined Amata had intense memories of his time studying in Vienna, which may have accounted for the deep absorption in German music, or it could have been the opposite. Maybe his love of German music had come first, and that's why he had chosen to study in Vienna instead of France. I had no way of knowing which had come first. Either way, I was in no position to complain that German music was the preferred type in this house. I was a mere caretaker, and they were kind enough to let me listen to the records there, and I enjoyed listening to the music of Bach, Schubert, Brahms, Schumann, and Beethoven, not forgetting Mozart, of course. Their music was deep, amazing, and gorgeous. Up to then in my life, I'd never had the opportunity to really settle down and listen to that type of music. I'd always been too busy trying to make a living and didn't have the wherewithal financially. So I decided that as long as I'd been provided this wonderful opportunity, I'd listen to as much music here as I could. After 11, I fell asleep for a while on the sofa listening to music. I might have slept for about 20 minutes. When I woke up, the record was over, the arm back in its cradle, the turntable not moving. There were two players in the living room, one an automatic, the other an old school manual type, but to play it safe, so I could fall asleep listening, in other words, I generally used the automatic. I slipped the Schubert record back in its jacket and returned it to its designated spot on the record shelf. From the open window, I could hear the clamor of insects. Since they were still making a racket, I wouldn't be hearing the sound of the bell quite yet. I warmed up coffee in the kitchen and munched on a few cookies, and listened intently to the noisy insect ensemble that enveloped the mountains. A little before 12:30, I heard the jaguar slowly making its way up the slope. As it changed direction, the pair of yellow headlights lit up the window. The engine finally cut out, and I heard the usual solid thunk as the door shut. I sat on the sofa, sipping coffee, getting my breathing under control, waiting for the front doorbell to ring. Chapter 13. At this point, it's merely a hypothesis. We sat in chairs in the living room, drank our coffee, and talked, killing time until that time rolled around. At first, we chatted about inconsequential things, but after a curtain of silence descended on us, Manshiki, a bit hesitantly yet resolutely, asked, "Do you have any children?" The question took me by surprise. He didn't seem the type to ask that kind of question, especially of someone he didn't know well. He seemed more the "I won't stick my nose in your business if you won't stick yours in mine" type of person. At least that's the way I read him. But when I looked up and saw his serious expression, I knew it wasn't an impulsive question. He'd been thinking of asking me this for a long time. I responded, "I was married for 6 years, but we didn't have any children." "You didn't want any?" "I was fine either way, but my wife didn't want any," I said. I didn't, though, get into the reason she gave. Even now, I'm not sure that it reflected her true feelings. Manshiki seemed hesitant, but forged ahead. "This might sound rude, but have you ever considered that there might be another woman somewhere, other than your wife, who secretly had a child of yours?" I looked him full in the face again. What a strange question. I rummaged around, pro forma, through a few drawers of memory, but came up empty-handed. I hadn't had sex with all that many women until then, and even if something like that had taken place, I think I would have heard about it. "I guess it's possible in theory, but realistically, commonsensically, you might say, it's not." "I see," Manshiki said. He quietly sipped his coffee, thinking deeply. "Why do you ask?" I ventured.
He looked out the window, silent for a time. The moon was visible, not as weirdly bright as 2 days ago, but still plenty bright. Scattered clouds slowly wended their way from the sea toward the mountains. Menshiki finally spoke up. "As I mentioned before, I've never been married. I've always been a bachelor. Work kept me busy all the time, that's one reason. But it's also because living with someone else didn't fit my personality and lifestyle. I'm sure this sounds pretty stuck up, but I'm the type who can only live alone. I have almost no interest in lineage or relatives. I've never thought I'd like to have children. There's a personal reason for that, mostly because of my home environment when I was growing up." He paused, took a breath, then went on. "But a few years ago, I began to think that I might actually have a child, or I should say, I was compelled to think that way." No comment from me. "I find it strange myself that I'm opening up to you about this kind of personal matter. I mean, we just met." The faintest of smiles rose to Menshiki's lips. "I'm okay with it as long as you are." "Ever since I was little, for some reason, people have tended to open up to me about the most unexpected topics. Maybe I have an innate ability to draw out secrets from strangers, or maybe I just seem like a good listener, I don't know. Either way, I don't remember it ever working to my advantage. After people tell me their secrets, they always regret it." "This is the first time I've ever told anybody this," Menshiki said. I nodded and waited for more. "Everyone says the same thing." Menshiki began his story. "This happened 15 years ago, when I was going out with a woman. I was in my late 30s then. She was in her late 20s. She was a beautiful, attractive woman, extremely bright. I was serious about our relationship, though I'd made it clear to her there was no chance of us getting married. I don't plan to ever marry anyone, I told her. I didn't want her to have any false hopes. If she ever found someone else she wanted to marry, I would step aside without a word. She understood exactly how I felt. While we went out for about 2.5 years, we got along really well. We never argued, even once. We traveled together to lots of places, and she'd often stay over at my place. She even kept a set of clothes there." He seemed to be contemplating something, then continued his story. "If I were a normal person, or closer to being normal, I wouldn't have hesitated to marry her. But..." He paused here and let out a small breath. "But the upshot was, I chose the kind of life I have now, a quiet life all by myself, and she chose a healthier life for herself. In other words, she got married to another man who was closer to being normal than me." Until the very end, however, she didn't disclose to him the fact that she was getting married. The last time he saw her was a week after her 29th birthday. The two of them had dined out at a restaurant in Ginza on her birthday, and later on he recalled how unusually quiet she'd been. He was working in an office in Akasaka then, and she'd called him saying she wanted to see him and talk, and asked if she could see him right away. "Of course," he replied. She'd never visited his workplace even once, but he hadn't thought it odd. His office was a small place, just him and a middle-aged woman secretary, so he didn't need to worry about anyone else if she stopped by. There had been a time when he'd managed a large company with lots of employees, but at this point he was developing a new network by himself. His usual approach was to work quietly by himself to develop a new business strategy. Then, when he began implementing the plan, he would aggressively employ a broad range of talent. It was just before 5 p.m. when his girlfriend showed up. They sat down together on his office sofa to talk. He'd had the secretary in the next room go home. It was his normal routine to continue working alone in the office after his secretary left for the day. Often he'd be so engrossed in his work that he'd stay all night. His idea was for the two of them to go to a nearby restaurant and have dinner, but she turned that down. "I don't have time today," she said. "I have to meet somebody in Ginza." "You said you had something you wanted to talk about," he said. "No, I don't have anything to really talk about," she said. "I just wanted to see you." "I'm glad you came," he said, smiling. It had been some time since she'd spoken so openly to him. She generally spoke in a more indirect, roundabout way. He had no idea what this portended. She moved over on the sofa and sat down in his lap. She put her arms around him and kissed him. A serious, deep kiss, tongues entwined. She reached out and undid Menshiki's belt. She took out his already erect penis, holding it in her grasp for a time. Then she leaned forward and wrapped her mouth around it. She slowly ran the tip of her long tongue around it. Her tongue was smooth and hot. This all came out of nowhere. She was usually more passive when it came to sex, especially oral sex, and when it came to doing it, or having things done to her, he'd always felt a slight resistance on her part. But now, here she was taking the lead. What's come over her? He wondered. She suddenly stood up, tossed aside her expensive black pumps, briskly lowered her stockings and panties, again sat down on his lap, and now guided his penis inside her. Her vagina was wet and moved smoothly, naturally, like some living being. The whole sequence had happened so quickly and was so unlike her, since she was always so calm and deliberate. Before he realized it, he was deep inside her, that smooth wall completely enveloping his penis, squeezing him silently yet insistently. This was unlike any sex he'd ever had with her. It was at once hot and cold, hard and soft. It was a strange, contradictory sensation, as if he were being simultaneously accepted and rejected. He had no idea what that meant. She straddled him, and like a person on a small boat being tossed around by the waves, moved violently up and down. Her black hair tossed about, supple as a willow branch in a strong wind. She lost control, her gasps growing ever louder. Menshiki wasn't sure if he had locked the office door or not. He felt he had, but also that he'd forgotten to. But this wasn't the time to go check. "Shouldn't we use a condom or something?" he managed to ask. She was always careful about contraception. "It's okay. Today," she gasped in his ear. "Don't worry about a thing." Everything about her was different from usual, as if a totally different personality dormant inside her had awoken and hijacked her body and soul. Menshiki imagined that today must be some sort of special day for her. There was so much that men can't fathom about women's bodies. Her movements became increasingly frenzied. There was nothing he could do but make sure not to interfere with what she desired. They neared climax. He couldn't hold back and ejaculated, and in time with that, she let out a short screech like some foreign bird, and her womb, as if waiting for that instant, greedily absorbed his semen. A muddied image occurred to him of himself, in the darkness, being devoured by a greedy beast. After a while, she stood up as if pushing his body aside, and silently adjusted the hem of her dress, stuffed the stockings and panties that had fallen to the floor in her handbag, and hurried off to the bathroom, bag in hand. She didn't come out for a long time. He was beginning to get worried that something had happened to her when she finally emerged. Her clothing and hair were neatly arranged now, her makeup redone. Her usual calm smile graced her lips. She gave Menshiki a light peck on the lips and told him she had to go, since she was already late, and she hurried out of the office without looking back. He could still recall the click of her pumps as she left. That was the last time he ever saw her. All contact ceased. He'd call her and write, but never got a response. And 2 months later, she got married. He heard about this from a mutual friend after the fact. The friend found it odd that Menshiki was not invited to the wedding ceremony, and, in particular, that he had no idea she was getting married. He'd always thought that Menshiki and the woman were good friends. They'd always been very discreet about their relationship, and no one else had known they were lovers. Menshiki didn't know the man she married. He had never even heard his name. She hadn't told Menshiki she was planning to marry, nor even hinted at it. She just disappeared from his world without a word. That violent embrace on the sofa at his office, Menshiki realized, must have been her final farewell act of love. Afterward, he went over those events, over and over in his mind. Even after a long time had passed, those memories remained amazingly distinct and clear. The creak of the sofa, her hair whirling around her, her hot breath in his ear, it all came back to him. So did Menshiki regret losing her? Of course not. He wasn't the type to have regrets. He knew very well he wasn't suited to family life. No matter how much he loved someone, he still couldn't share his life with them. He needed solitary time every day to concentrate, and he couldn't stand it when someone's presence threw off his concentration. If he lived with someone, he knew he would end up detesting them, whether it was his parents, a wife, or children. He feared that above all. He wasn't afraid of loving someone. What he feared was growing to hate someone. For all that, he had loved her very deeply. He'd never loved any other woman so deeply, and probably never would again. "Even now, there's a special spot inside me just for her," Menshiki said. "A very real spot. You might even call it a shrine." A shrine? This struck me as an odd choice of words, but for him, it was likely the right way of putting it. Menshiki ended his story there. He'd told this private tale in great detail, yet I got little sense of it being sexual. It was more like he'd read aloud from a medical report. Or maybe it really was that sort of dispassionate experience for him. 7 months after the wedding, she gave birth to a baby girl in a hospital in Tokyo, Menshiki continued. 13 years ago. I heard about this birth much later from someone. Menshiki stared down at his now empty coffee cup, as if nostalgic for some past age when it had been full of hot coffee. "And that child might possibly be my own," he said, seemingly forcing out the words. He looked at me, like he wanted to hear my opinion. It took me a while to grasp what he was trying to say. "Does the timeline fit?" "It does. It coincides perfectly. The child was born 9 months after she came to my office.
She must have picked the day she was most fertile to come see me and, how should I put it, deliberately gathered my sperm. That's my working hypothesis. From the beginning, she wasn't expecting to marry me, but had decided to have my child. I figured that's what happened.
But you can't confirm that, I said.
Of course. At this point, it's merely a hypothesis. But I do have a sort of basis to say this.
That was a pretty risky experiment for her, wasn't it? I pointed out. If the blood types didn't match, it might come out that the father was someone else. Would she risk that?
My blood type is A. Most Japanese are A, and I think she is too. As long as they didn't have some reason to run a full-blown DNA test, the chances are slim that the secret would come out. That much she could figure out.
But on the other hand, unless you ran an official DNA test, you wouldn't be able to determine if you're the girl's biological father or not, right? Or else you ask her mother directly.
Minshiki shook his head. It's no longer possible to ask the mother. She died 7 years ago.
That's terrible. She was still so young, I said.
She was walking in the woods and was stung by hornets and died. She was allergic to them. By the time they got her to the hospital, she'd stopped breathing. Nobody knew she was so allergic to their stings. Maybe she didn't even know herself. She left behind her husband and daughter. Her daughter is 13 now.
About the same age as my little sister was when she died, I thought. And you have some sort of basis for conjecturing that this girl is your daughter. Is that what you're saying?
Sometime after she died, I suddenly received a letter from the deceased. Minshiki said in a quiet voice.
One day, a large envelope with a return receipt arrived at his office from a law firm he'd never heard of. Inside was a typed 2-page letter with the letterhead of the law firm and a light pink envelope. The letter from the law firm was signed by a lawyer. The lawyer's letter read, "Ms. Blank entrusted me with this letter while she was still alive. Ms. Blank left instructions with me to send this letter to you in case of her death. She added a note to the effect that the letter should be for your eyes only." That was the gist of the lawyer's letter. The circumstances leading to her death were described simply in a businesslike manner. Minshiki was speechless, but finally pulled himself together and snipped open the second envelope. The letter inside was handwritten in blue ink on 4 sheets of stationery. The handwriting was exquisite.
"Dear Mr. Minshiki, I don't know what month or year it is now, but if you are reading this, it means I am no longer among the living. I'm not sure why, but I've always had the feeling I'd depart this world at a relatively young age, which is why I made full preparations like this for after my death. If all this ends up being wasted, of course nothing could be better. But when all is said and done, since you are reading this letter, it means that I've already passed away. The thought leaves me very, very sad. The first thing I'd like to say in advance, maybe it's something I really don't need to say, is that my life has never been of much consequence. I'm well aware of that. So it seems fitting for someone like me to quietly exit the world without making a big deal of things, without any uncalled-for pronouncements. But there is one thing I need to tell you alone. My conscience is telling me that if I don't, I may forever lose the chance to treat you fairly. So I've left this letter with a lawyer I know and trust, with instructions to pass it on to you. Suddenly leaving you like that, and marrying someone else, and not saying a word to you about it beforehand, I am deeply sorry about all of it. I can imagine how shocked and upset you must have been. But you're always so calm, so maybe it didn't shock you or bother you. At any rate, that was the only path I could follow. I won't get into details here, but I do want you to understand that. I was left with hardly any other choice. But one choice was left to me. A choice that was condensed in one event, in one act. Do you remember the last time I saw you? That evening in early fall when I suddenly came to your office. Maybe I didn't seem like it, but I was at my wit's end then, completely driven into a corner. I no longer felt like I was myself anymore. But even in that confused state of mind, the act I did was utterly intentional, and I've never, ever regretted it. This was something profoundly important in my life, something far surpassing my own existence. I am hoping that you will understand my intentions and ultimately forgive me, and I pray that none of this will cause you personally any harm, since I know very well how much you dislike those kinds of things. I wish you a long and happy life, and I hope that what a truly wonderful person you were will be passed along in all its richness for a long time to come. Blank. Menshiki read the letter over so many times that he memorized it all, and he recited it to me without faltering. All sorts of emotions and suggestions played back and forth through the letter, light and dark, shadow and sunlight, creating a complex hidden picture. Like a linguistic scholar researching an ancient language no one speaks anymore, he spent years considering the possibilities concealed in the letter's contents, extracting each word and phrasing, recombining them, intertwining them, shifting their order, and he arrived at one conclusion alone, that the baby girl she gave birth to 7 months after she got married was, he was now certain, conceived in that office, on that leather sofa, with him. I asked a law office I knew to investigate the daughter she left behind, Menshiki said. Her husband was 15 years older than she was, worked in real estate. Or rather, he was the son of a local landowner and managed the land and properties he'd inherited from his father. He had some other real estate holdings too, of course, but wasn't that ambitious when it came to expanding the business. He had enough assets to live on comfortably without working. The daughter's name was Maria. The husband had not remarried after his wife's accidental death 7 years ago. The husband has an unmarried younger sister who lives with them and takes care of the household. Maria is in her first year at a local public junior high. And have you met this girl, Maria? Menshiki was silent as he chose his words. I've seen her from a distance many times, but never spoken with her. And what did you think when you saw her? Did she look like me? I couldn't say. If I think there's a resemblance, then everything about her resembles me. But if I don't think that way, then I don't see a resemblance at all. Do you have a photo of her? Menshiki silently shook his head. No, I don't. I could get one easily enough, but that's not what I was after. What good is carrying around a photo of her in my wallet going to do? What I'm after is... But nothing came after this. He was silent, the quiet buried in the lively buzz of the hordes of insects outside. But you told me earlier, Mr. Menshiki, that you were totally uninterested in blood relations.
True enough.
I've never cared about lineage. In fact, I've lived my life trying to avoid that as much as I could. My feelings haven't changed,
But still, I find I can't take my eyes off this girl, Maria. I simply can't stop thinking about her. There's no reason for it, but still... I couldn't find the right words to say. Menshiki continued. I've never had this experience before. I've always been very self-controlled, even proud of it. But sometimes now, I find it painful to be alone. I went ahead and said what was on my mind. Mr. Menshiki, this is just a hunch on my part, but it seems like there's something you want me to do in regard to Maria. Or am I overthinking things? After a pause, Menshiki nodded. I'm not sure how I should put this. I realized at that instant that the clamor of insects had completely stopped. I looked up at the clock on the wall. It was just past 1:40. I held a finger up to my lips, and Menshiki stopped in mid-sentence, and the two of us listened carefully in the still of the night. Chapter 14. But something this strange is a first. Menshiki and I stopped talking and sat still, listening carefully. The insects had stopped chirping just like they had 2 days ago and again yesterday. In the midst of that deep silence, I could again make out the tinkling of the bell. It rang a few times with uneven periods of silence in between before ringing once again. I looked over at Menshiki, seated across from me on the sofa. I could tell he was hearing the same sound. He was frowning. He lifted up his hands on his lap, his fingers moving slightly in time to the ringing of the bell. So this wasn't an auditory hallucination. After listening intently to the bell for 2 or 3 minutes, Menshiki slowly rose from the sofa.
Let's go where that sound's coming from, he said dryly.
I picked up my flashlight. He went outside and retrieved a large flashlight from his Jaguar. We climbed the 7 steps and walked into the woods. Though not as bright as 2 days before, the autumn moonlight clearly lit the path for us. We walked in back of the little shrine, pushing aside pampas grass as we went, and emerged in front of the stone mound. And again, we perked up our ears. No doubt about it. The sound was coming from the cracks between the stones. Menshiki slowly circled the mound, cautiously shining his flashlight into the cracks between the stones. But nothing was out of the ordinary, just a jumble of old moss-covered stones. He looked over at me. In the moonlight, his face resembled some mask from ancient times. Perhaps my face looked the same?
When you heard the sound before, was it coming from here?
He whispered.
The same place, I said. The exact same spot. It sounds like someone underneath the stones is ringing a bell, Menshiki said.
I nodded. I felt relieved to know I wasn't crazy, but I had to admit that the unreality of the situation had now, through Menshiki, taken on a reality, creating a slight gap in the seam of the world.
What should we do?
I asked Menshiki. He shone his flashlight on where the sound was coming from, his lips tight as he considered the situation. In the still of the night, I could almost hear the wheels turning in his mind.
Someone might be seeking help,
Menshiki said quietly, as if to himself.
But who could have possibly gotten under these heavy stones?
Menshiki shook his head. He had no idea either.
Anyway, let's go back to the house, he said.
He lightly touched my shoulders from behind.
At least we've pinpointed the source of the sound.
Let's go home and talk it over.
We cut through the woods and came out onto the empty space in front of the house. Menshiki opened the door of his Jaguar and returned the flashlight. In its place, he took out a small paper bag. We went back inside the house.
If you have any whiskey, could I have a glass? Menshiki asked. Regular scotch, okay?
Of course. Straight, please. With a separate glass of water, no ice.
I went into the kitchen and took a bottle of white label from the shelf, poured some into two glasses, and took them and some mineral water out to the living room. We sat across from each other without speaking and drank our straight whiskey. I went back to the kitchen to get the bottle of white label and poured him a refill. He picked up the glass, but didn't drink any. In the silence of the middle of the night, the bell continued to ring out intermittently. A small sound, but with a delicate weight one couldn't fail to hear.
I've seen a lot of strange things in my time, but something this strange is a first, Menshiki said. Pardon me for saying this, but when you first told me about this, I only half believed you. It's hard to believe something like this could actually happen.
Something in that expression caught my attention. What do you mean, could actually happen? Menshiki raised his head and looked me in the eyes.
I read about this sort of thing in a book once, he said.
You mean hearing a bell from somewhere in the middle of the night?
No, what they heard was a gong, not a bell. The kind of gong they would ring along with a drum when searching for a lost child. In the old days, it was a small Buddhist altar fitting that you would hit with a wooden bell hammer. You'd strike it rhythmically as you chanted sutras. In the story, someone heard that kind of gong ringing out from underground in the middle of the night.
Was this a ghost story?
Closer to what's called a tale of the mysterious. Have you ever read Ueda Akinari's book, Tales of the Spring Rain? Menshiki asked.
I shook my head. I read his Tales of Moonlight and Rain a long time ago, but I haven't read that one.
Tales of the Spring Rain is a collection of stories Akinari wrote in his later years, some 40 years after he finished Tales of Moonlight and Rain. Compared with that book, which emphasized narrative, Tales of the Spring Rain was more an expression of Akinari's philosophy as a man of letters. One strange story in the collection is titled Fate Over Two Generations. The main character experiences something like what you're going through. He's the son of a wealthy farmer. He enjoys studying, and one night he's reading late, when he hears a sound like a gong coming from underneath a rock in the corner of the garden. Thinking it odd, the next day he has people dig it up, and they find a large stone underneath. When they move that stone, they find a kind of coffin with a stone lid. Inside that, they discover a fleshless, emaciated person, like a dried fish, with hair down to his knees. Only his hands are still moving, striking a gong with a wooden hammer. It was a Buddhist priest who long ago chose his own death in order to achieve enlightenment and had himself buried alive in the coffin. This act was called Zenjo. The mummified dead body was unearthed and enshrined in a temple. Another term for Zenjo is Nyujo, meaning a deep meditative practice. The man must have originally been quite a highly revered priest. As he had hoped, his soul reached nirvana, and the soulless physical body alone continued to live on. The main character's family had lived on this plot of land for 10 generations, and this burial must have taken place before that. In other words, several centuries before.
Menshiki ended there. So you're saying the same sort of thing took place around this house?
I asked.
Menshiki shook his head.
If you think about it, it's not possible. This was just a take on the supernatural written in the Edo period. Akinari knew that this tale had become part of folk legend, and he adapted it and created the story Fate over two generations. What I'm saying is, the story does have strange parallels with what we're experiencing now.
He lightly shook his glass of whiskey, the amber liquid quietly oscillating in his hand.
So after he was unearthed, what happened? I asked.
The story took off in strange directions, Menshiki replied, sounding hesitant to go into it.
Ueda Akinari's worldview late in his life is deeply reflected in that story. A quite cynical view of the world, really. Akinari had a complicated background, a man who went through a lot of troubles in his life. But rather than hearing me summarize, I suggest you read the story yourself.
Menshiki took an old book out of the paper bag he'd brought inside from the car and handed it to me. A volume from a collection of classical Japanese literature. The book contained the entire text of Akinari's two most famous books, Tales of Moonlight and Rain and Tales of the Spring Rain.
When you told me what was going on here, right away I recalled this story. Just to be sure, I reread the copy I had on my shelves. I'll give you the book. If you'd like, please take a look. It's a short tale and doesn't take long to read.
I thanked him and accepted the book. It's all pretty strange, I said. Kind of unbelievable. Of course, I'll read it. But apart from all that, what am I actually supposed to do? I don't think I can just leave things the way they are. If somebody really is buried beneath those rocks, ringing a bell or gong or whatever, sending out a call for help every night, we have to help him get out.
Menshiki frowned. But the two of us would never be able to move that pile of stones.
Should we report it to the police?
Menshiki shook his head a few times. The police won't be any help. Once you report that you're hearing a bell ringing from under stones in a woods in the middle of the night, they're not going to take you seriously. They'll just think you're crazy. It could make things worse. Better not go there.
But if that bell keeps ringing every night, I don't think my nerves can take it. I can't get much sleep. All I can do is move out of this house. That sound is definitely trying to tell us something.
Menshiki considered this. We'll need a professional's help to move those rocks, he said. There's a man I know pretty well who's a local landscape designer. He's used to moving heavy rocks and landscaping. If need be, he could arrange for a small backhoe. Then it'd be easy to move the rocks and dig a hole.
Okay, but I see two problems with that, I said. First, I'd have to get permission to do that work from the son of the owner. I can't decide anything on my own. And second, I don't have the funds to hire someone to do that kind of job.
Menshiki smiled. Don't worry about the money. I'll take care of that. What I mean is that designer owes me one, and I think he'll do it at cost. Don't worry about that. As for Mr. Amada, why don't you get in touch with him? If you explain the situation, I think he'll give permission. If somebody really is shut away underneath those rocks and we just leave him to his fate, Mr. Amada will be liable for it as the property owner.
But to ask you, an outsider, to go to all that trouble...
Menshiki spread his hands wide on his lap, as if catching the rain. His voice was quiet. I mentioned this before, but I'm a very curious person. I'd like to find out how this odd story will play out. It's not something you run across every day. So, like I said, don't worry about how much it'll cost. I understand you have your own position to consider, but let me arrange everything. I looked Manshiki in the eye. There was a keen light there I hadn't seen before.